Hello and welcome to the Society for Acute Medicine's podcast. Here we discuss topics, cases, and anything new and upcoming in the world of acute medicine. This is our view and take. Remember to always do your own reading around the topics we discuss. Enjoy!
Hello and welcome back to another episode of SAM's Acute Medical Podcast. This is Peter Ng and I am joined here by Damien Dewey. Hello, Damien.
Hi, Peter.
And we are honoured by a very special guest today. We have Dr. Hassan Burhan, who I'm privileged to work with in my trust. He's a respiratory consultant with an interest in asthma. Hello, Hassan.
Hello. Honoured is a bit strong, but nice to be here. Thank you so much.
So we're here to talk about asthma. Asthma is a very common condition that we see in intake on a daily basis. And I'm not entirely sure whether it's very well managed on the ground floor or in the emergency departments and the acute medical unit. Certainly, I feel asthma is relatively well managed when it's barn door, but I feel the patient who comes in query asthma or the severe asthmatics, I'm not entirely sure whether I'm always doing the right thing. And so part of the reason we've invited Hassan here is to tell me what to do. So I'm going to hand this over to Damien to start off with the first of two cases. Over to you, Damien.
Thanks, Peter. So asthma. So I just done an on-call weekend, and asthma came up quite a bit, to be fair. There was a few patients that have come in, different ages, different presentations, but at the crux of it was asthma exacerbations. So I'm glad we're doing this talk today, because the juniors on the take had some questions for me, and some of them I did scratch my head about. I was like, oh, do we do this? Do we give this? So hopefully we're going to talk about that all today, which is good. So we're going to do a bit of a case-based one. So we'll start with the first case. So this is a 19-year-old gentleman who presents to A&E. He's got a three-day history of shortness of breath, bit of a cough with some yellow phlegm or sputum. He's wheezy, but his observations are fine. His saturations are 97% on room air. His respiratory rate's only 19. Could this be asthma? Could this be something else? What do you think?
So, yeah, it certainly could be asthma. We might be in a very lucky position here, because he could have turned up to A&E during office hours, and he could have a wheeze, because asthma by its nature, the symptoms come and go. So we might be in a position to make a diagnosis in someone who is naive to treatment and has symptoms. So if you don't have a wheeze, and if you're not breathless on any given day, you obviously could have asthma and you could be having a good day. So this chap might well have asthma. He's 19, he's got a wheeze, and he's bad enough to need to turn up to A&E. And wouldn't it be nice if it was office hours to do spirometry with reversibility and answer the question when he's unwell? Because he's got symptoms that are variable, presumably, and he's turned up to A&E. If he's got airflow obstruction that improves after he's had a blue inhaler and he's got some evidence of inflammation, then you have all three hallmarks of asthma. So he certainly could have asthma. A lot of the guidance that's out there is directed to primary care, isn't it? So one of the things that's great to see evidence in the BTS signed guidelines last iteration in 2019 is examine the patient or do tests when they're unwell or when they have symptoms or when they don't have symptoms. So he could well have asthma. And I think it's important to listen to the chest. It's also important to do some measure of airflow obstruction. And if possible, certainly if someone's been admitted to the acute medicine unit, then it will be possible in A&E, perhaps not always. It's a great idea to do spirometry with reversibility, because your chance of catching that airflow obstruction which reverses with the bronchodilator is much greater when someone's acutely unwell. So it could well be asthma.
So spirometry front door, if he had a bit of a chest infection, should I do the spirometry then? Should I wait a week, wait a month? When's the best time to do the spirometry on patients that, say, have a bit of an infection as well? Because it's got a bit of yellow sputum.
Yeah. I mean, it's got yellow sputum. I suppose if you heard crackles over a particular area and you're thinking this was lobar pneumonia, then perhaps not. If he's got yellow sputum can be caused by asthma, it can be bronchitis, acute bronchitis. You know, it may or may not be an infection. I think it's a different situation if you're looking at someone who's got clear lobar pneumonia on an X-ray, then perhaps spirometry isn't the best thing to do. You know, it could be infection, but what you're looking for in asthma is perhaps what you want is bad spirometry. And that's what people struggle with in primary care. So we're in a great position because this person's in or near a hospital to be able to prove that he has airflow obstruction. And then when he's better and you do spirometry and it's normal, bingo, you have a diagnosis. I suppose the important differential here is post-viral bronchospasm, which is not necessarily asthma, but the treatment is the same. Airflow obstruction, which can get better, but you'd certainly treat with at least inhaled corticosteroids and short-acting beta agonists for a few months and then think about withdrawing treatment. But wheezy, yellow sputum, it's either infection triggering a wheeze or it's propensity to wheeze and intermittent symptoms and airflow obstruction, ergo asthma.
That's interesting. That's probably going to change my practice now, because I would have always have thought, oh, I have to make them better.
Yeah. Wait, and then check weeks, it. And then
but it makes it does yeah. make sense.
The 19-year-old chap with SATs of 97 and a respiratory rate of 19 is the perfect candidate for clinching the diagnosis.
Yeah.
You know, obviously SATs of 91, respiratory rate of 30, oral steroids, et cetera, oxygen, you know. If this chap ends up in hospital for 3 days, he will get 4 sets of blood pressure every day. Does he need it? No. Mm-hmm. He'll get not a single spirometry. Does he need it? Yes.
Okay. That's very helpful. That's our first pearl, I would say. Just remind us with regards to spirometry, because quite often we get spirometry reports coming back to my inbox and I have to interpret them. Just remind us, what is the criteria for reversibility?
12% and 200 mils so of FEV1. So if it's 12% in someone with COPD whose FEV1 is only 0.8 litres anyway, and it's that 12% equates to 50, 70, 90 mils, then that's not asthma. I think what's really important is that you don't have to reverse to normal. So if people, not this 19-year-old chap, but if people have had asthma for a long time, never smoked, and had ongoing inflammation which hasn't been treated, they're going to end up with fixed airflow obstruction. So as long as you've got a minimum of 12% and 200 mils improvement in FEV1, it doesn't have to be normalization of the FEV1-FVC ratio, then according to ERS-ATS guidelines, that is asthma.
Sure.
And on that topic, we used to talk about ACOS, and there was a trend for ACOS a while ago, wasn't there? Asthma COPD overlap syndrome. So no one in Liverpool has never smoked, and no one in Liverpool is perfectly clear asthma and perfectly clear COPD. There's a lot of grey area. There's people with 15 pack years or, you know, 40 pack years. But my key to differentiating the two is, what can you do on a good day? What can you do on a bad day? And if they can walk around the park with their dog twice on a good day, then it ain't COPD, regardless of how much they've smoked. The kind of point I was going to make really with the ACOS side of things is, the reason it was called ACOS is asthma trumps COPD. So obviously now with COPD guidance and maintenance of COPD, inhaled corticosteroid is the, not even the icing on the cake. Yes, the icing on the cake or the cherry on top of the cake. Whereas in asthma, of course, inhaled corticosteroid saves lives. So it's the cake itself. So I talk about people having both asthma and COPD. And the important thing is that they need inhaled corticosteroids. And there might be alternative treatments like biologics if it's asthma that we're treating.
So this young guy, obs are fine. He's probably sitting in the SDEC or A&E or another assessment area, such as the corridor these days. He probably can go home. What's the role of steroids in him? So I've heard you mention hydrocortisone, prednisolone, inhaled steroids. What would you advise given this young guy?
Okay, so he's bad enough to turn up to hospital. And let's assume this is asthma. So it's a Saturday morning, we can't get spirometry, but it sounds like asthma. Nothing obvious on the X-ray. Blood eosinophils are 0.4. Sounds like asthma, we're treating for asthma. So he needs oral steroids just by virtue of the fact that he's turned up. We would, of course, do a peak flow once we're happy that it's asthma. And if someone's blue and not talking, then emergency asthma management is easy, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It's the people with a peak flow of kind of 30% predicted, but look okay, that are the really dangerous ones. So let's not talk so much about the acute management. We might talk about that later. But in terms of what are we going to do with him, we're going to give him some oral steroids. His wheezing is turned up to hospital. So he's going to have at least 3 days of 40 milligrams of prednisolone if he's going home, 3 to 5 days. He is going to start on an inhaled steroid. And he's bad enough to turn up to hospital. So we might have missed that opportunity of looking at peak flow reversibility or arranging spirometry beforehand. We're going to assume this is asthma until we prove otherwise, and it's probably going to be primary care that might be proving otherwise. But anyone with asthma needs inhaled steroids. And for people that live in other parts of the world, like North America, Australia, people that are newly diagnosed with asthma don't get a salbutamol inhaler. They don't get SABA, they get ICS and LABA, which is quick acting. So it's like maintenance and reliever therapy, but the only inhaler that they can reach for has got some inhaled steroid in it. So if it's asthma, inhale steroid. If you're not sure and they're bad enough to come into hospital, inhale steroid. And if they're bad enough to come into hospital, you know, with their breathing and there's a wheeze, but their peak flow is actually fine, and I suppose there might be 5% of people in whom it's a judgment call where you think maybe they were just anxious and it's not asthma. But generally, asthma equals inhaled steroid, bad enough to be in hospital, equals a short burst of oral steroid.
What inhaled steroid would you suggest? We're not sponsored by anybody. So.
Yeah. I'm sponsored by everybody. So, for this 19-year-old chap who should have reasonable inhalatory flow and should be able to take any inhaler, then I'd go for a dry powder inhaler preferentially. And I would actually, again, if this chap was living in other parts of the world, there would be one inhaler. So you don't have to worry so much about marrying your preventer to your reliever. I think one of the problems with dry powder inhalers is that people get an MDI reliever generally. Yeah. So you have to teach them two inhaler techniques. But I would certainly go for an ICS LABA as first choice in this person because they're bad enough to come into hospital. And I would put them straight onto maintenance and reliever therapy. So I would go for something like either Symbicort, which is via turbohaler, or Fostair, which can be either a dry powder inhaler or an MDI inhaler. And one puff morning and night, one puff in between. And those, both of those have their own specific action plans. And that's because I remember what it was like being 19. Mm. You don't take medication when you're unwell. But you'd obviously want him to take medication when he's unwell. But if he didn't, then at least he'd be reaching for something with an inhaled steroid. That hasn't quite reached the guidelines in the UK, but that approach is certainly on the guidelines elsewhere. So I prescribe him maintenance and reliever therapy with an inhaled corticosteroid, ideally a dry powder inhaler. But the worst inhaler and the most expensive inhaler, of course, is the one that is never used. So I would show him how to use a dry powder inhaler. And if he can use it, then that's what I'd send him home with. If he genuinely can't use it and is better with a MDI, with or without spacer, then that's what I'd send him home with.
I think that's one of the biggest barriers in the emergency departments and the acute medical unit, particularly out of hours, is getting that inhaled corticosteroid to the patient and showing them how to use it. Because ask me how to use a dry powder inhaler, I could probably potential work it out, but am I doing it right? I don't actually know. It feels like inhalers are changing so frequently. Any tips on what to do out of hours? Should we just ask them to pick up the inhaled corticosteroid from the pharmacist and rely on the pharmacist to educate?
So if you're sending someone home from AMU out of hours, they would presumably get their essential medication to go home with. So we should be able to get hold of one, I imagine, if they're going home. I would get them to look at a website called Right Breathe, which is easy to remember. It's not that user-friendly an interface when you get on the website, but I always tell patients to type the name of their inhaler in the box at the top of the website, and that's got useful links to videos. So I sometimes get the patient's phone and get them to log onto the internet and show them the website on the internet, show them the inhaler that I'm prescribing and make sure that they can use it.
Okay.
And in general, slow, and deep as opposed to hard and fast and deep and hold your breath afterwards are the general kind of DPI and MDI things. But I think you're right, Peter. The lack of confidence in inhaler technique is a big problem. Right Breathe website is important. Mm-hmm. Usually there are people around that are pretty expert at inhaler technique. There are millions of inhalers out there. Generally, dry powder versus MDI, slow and deep versus hard and fast are the two broad principles. And I think the Right Breathe website is useful. And the other thing this person, if we're, let's, you know, we're saying it's asthma, should go home with is an action plan as to what to do when things get worse, which is very underused, certainly in hospital, certainly in primary care. And there's good evidence that, that action plans help with asthma. There is one, there used to be, I'm showing my age now, but there used to be an A&E paper pro forma thing with some kind of action plan on the back of it that you could easily scribble out. I suppose the modern equivalent is the Asthma UK website has got an action plan, which is oft printed and you can write down the inhalers. Those action plans don't work quite so well for maintenance and reliever therapy, but yes to oral steroid, yes to inhale steroid, never SABO without inhale steroid and asthma and an action plan. And look at the website with them. It will take 30 seconds, maybe 2 minutes. You know, show them how to use the inhaler.
So that could be a quick win quip for our listeners, action plans at the front door. So the Right Breathe, the website you talk about, it's also got an app, which I've got on my phone. Okay. And whenever patients come in and say they're on the purple inhaler or the blue inhaler or the brown inhaler, I go through them like, is it that one? And then I use it to figure out which inhaler they're on as well, if you can't get access to the GP records. So it's a really good one. It's got the links to the videos as well when you do it. So it's really, really good, good for the technique and how to use it. We aren't paid by Right Breathe either. So get on that. I'm pretty sure it's free. The this app as well. App. So it is really good. And the app is actually quite user-friendly. It's quite good.
I've seen other people use the app. I haven't downloaded the app partly because my phone's rubbish. and also I quite like the interaction. I suppose asthma is all I do and I'm blessed with time, which you guys might not be at the front door. But I quite like the interaction of getting them to get their phone out, getting them to go onto the website and, you know, showing them how to use it. But I have the luxury, perhaps, of a few more minutes than you might do at the front door. And the Right Breathe app on your phone is really useful for that clerking bit, which I hadn't thought of.
So we've talked about some steroids in this patient. We've mentioned spirometry. We've mentioned peak flow. And we've talked about the different inhalers that could potentially go home on. We've mentioned the action plan as well. So when patients are being discharged and do an action plan, and we've talked about how that could be a quick win quip for some of our listeners. Is there anything else for this young guy who's quite well, bit of a wheeze, that you would suggest we would do differently at the front door that could get him properly managed and get him home safely, other than what you've said?
Again, what I do with my patients, and I've done a good amount of integrative care work. I used to work for the Knowsley Community Respiratory Service, where people that were suspected in primary care as having asthma were seen within a couple of weeks pre-COVID and had spirometry and pheno and were reviewed within a month by an asthma nurse and or consultant. So these are obviously different to our 19-year-old chap who's bad enough to come to hospital. They were, you know, well enough to wait for definitive diagnosis. But I think those kind of 5 minutes spent explaining what asthma is really important. So I always talk about upside down trees, and I talk about your windpipe being the trunk, and then you've got branches and twigs and leaves, and how asthma is a disease of the branches and twigs. And instead of being, and I gesticulate, which doesn't come across well on a podcast, but instead of being a nice open airway and a nice open branch or twig, it becomes narrow, and then it gets better. And then there's always inflammation, even when it gets better. And when you're bad, it's like your lungs are full of air. So take a deep breath in and try and breathe on top of that. And that's what it feels like when your asthma is bad. Because of these narrow tubes, it's easy to breathe in, but you can't breathe out. And patients always nod their head when you kind of get them to take a deep breath in and try and breathe on top of that, because that shows that you... Hopefully it's fairly easy to understand, and it shows that you understand what it's like to have asthma, and it kind of does something to explain the cause. And I think the hard bit to get your head around And it's understandably hard for patients because it's hard for us, I think, are these terms that we kind of use and take for granted. So severe asthma, this, you know, at the front door, severe asthma means something else to what it means in the community. So severe asthma is defined by peak flow, blue, not able to breathe at all, is life-threatening, you know, peak flow of less than 33% or less than 30%, but talking is severe. And severity is defined in the community by how much treatment you need to get on top of your asthma and be well controlled. So you can have severe asthma and be on lots of medication and intermittently be fine, but you've still got severe asthma. And control, what do we mean by control? It's how asthma manifests itself in daily life. So I think, you know, as well as that explanation as to what asthma is, the treatment is there to help you gain control of your asthma. But asthma doesn't go away, which again is a hard thing to understand when you're 19 years old, that you're going to need to be on some treatment for life, and which is again why different interpretations of the guidance in other countries, but which is why when you give people an inhaler to lean on in some places, it's got some steroid in it.
So I'm just going to ask two very quick questions. Well, they might be quick, but I'll ask them anyway, before we move on to our next case. So you've mentioned prednisolone, 40 milligrams. Why is asthma 40 milligrams and COPD 30 milligrams? And why is there a difference?
So there are some meta-analyses that are referred to in the guidelines, both from 2001, looking at the benefits of giving oral steroids early in asthma at the front door, which is well known, and also high versus low versus medium dose steroids. And I think high was above 80 milligrams. So it's based on meta-analyses and the doses that have been used in different studies. And I think Lisa Davis, also from Liverpool, seminal study from 1999 in COPD was 30 milligrams. So I think it's the doses that have been used in previous studies. And also, I talked about this asthma versus COPD thing. I think what's really important is I don't think that 10 milligrams necessarily makes any particular difference, but it perhaps helps alter your mindset as to whether you're treating asthma or whether you're treating COPD. And really that 10 milligram difference, I don't think necessarily makes much difference. It's just based on what was used in previous studies, but it changes where you're going. Because ultimately, philosophically, certainly in integrated care and primary care and secondary care, the management of asthma and COPD is kind of diametrically opposed to each other. Mm. Two. In asthma, if you're bad, you need to be in hospital because you can go off very quickly. In COPD, if you're bad, stay at home or go home quickly. So I think that changing from 30 to 40 milligrams perhaps doesn't make a difference in an individual patient, but it helps us think that we are managing asthma here. This is not someone that we're going to send home with nebulizers and nurse to pop in every day. This is someone that we need to get right before we send them home. It's kind of changes what we're aiming for.
And then the second question was, you mentioned FeNO. What's FeNO?
FeNO is fraction of exhaled nitric oxide, and it's measured in parts per billion. And certainly anything above 25 is elevated. I think of FeNO as the CRP of asthma diagnosis, where it's a piece in the jigsaw rather than a definitive answer. So people with nasal polyps can have a high FeNO. In people who smoke, the FeNO can be hard to interpret. But what can be quite useful is in an individual asthma patient with a high FeNO, and we're actually doing this in Aintree PCN at the moment with some money from NHS England, is we're taking people who've had six or more blue inhalers over a 12-month period, checking their inhaler technique, putting them on inhaled corticosteroid and labo, doing a FeNO, and then seeing them again in a month's time to make sure they've been using their inhaler correctly, and then showing them that their FeNO falls if it is asthma. So I think in that sense, it's very useful. So FeNO is part of the represents Th2 inflammation, can be useful as part of the whole package in diagnosing asthma, but on its own can be confusing. And there are suggestions from NICE and NHS England that we should be moving towards community airways diagnostic hubs. So I think FeNO on its own in isolation is potentially confusing because you can have someone who's fine with a high FeNO, or you can have someone who's terrible with a middling FeNO. So it's a tool of detecting Th2 inflammation. It's a biomarker, and I think it's useful in conjunction with spirometry in diagnosing asthma and monitoring response to inhaled corticosteroids.
Okay.
it's not something you'd suggest we do at the front door then. It's something that would be done in respiratory clinics.
I don't think it's something that's particularly useful at the front door. What is useful at the front door is a good old-fashioned full blood count. Eosinophils of 0.3 or more, which certainly, I think, in this hospital, certainly until a while ago, didn't come up as red. I think it had to be 0.5 to come up as red. But 0.3 is an elevated eosinophil count. And again, talking about this asthma and COPD thing, someone who's got 100 pack years but can walk around the park, if they've got eosinophils of 0.3 or 0.4, then it's worth referring to clinic to try and tease the two apart to see whether there might be more modern treatments such as biologics that they're suitable for. And certainly even in people with COPD that are not on inhaled corticosteroids at home, if they've got an eosinophilia, they probably should be. So they should be on a triple inhaler or ICS LABA. So eosinophils are worth looking at. And you mentioned, Damien, about looking at primary care records. I suppose my other integrated / primary care role really is also NHS England funded, looking at about 1,500 people in Liverpool that have got elevated eosinophils and asthma primary care diagnosis and three or more courses of steroids, and looking through their records and seeing them and trying to get them on biologics if appropriate. And it's amazing what you can see in a primary care record, because you can look back to 2011 and you can see this variable FEV1 that has now settled into fixed airflow obstruction. So they're the two things that I would use at the front door. FeNO, not so much.
Very good.
Okay. You asked the question I was going to ask is about whether we as acute medics should be ordering FeNO. just on a related question, related note then, we've discharged this patient, we're discharging with the appropriate inhaled corticosteroids. And with that patient, would you suggest that we refer back to the GP to confirm or refute that diagnosis? What kind of patient would you want us to refer to the asthma clinic?
Okay, so actually the BTS guidelines suggest that people are reviewed within 2 working days in primary care and within 2 weeks in secondary care. So I don't think either of those things happen too often. And I think we need to think differently as to how we do this. So I would refer that patient that you're describing to the asthma nurse in the hospital. I'd ask them to go back to their GP. The asthma nurse can hopefully follow them up within a couple of weeks, either on the phone or in person, to make sure they're doing okay. And what's going to happen, certainly in Liverpool, we have the funding for this, is those people will be reviewed in a diagnostic hub where they'll have spirometry with reversibility when stable, and then that'll be normal. But they'll be able to look in the notes for when Damien saw them and they had terrible airflow obstruction 2 months ago and the diagnosis is made. So I'd refer to the GP saying we think this person's got asthma, over to you, make the diagnosis. I'd refer to the asthma nurse, both as a kind of belt and braces approach. And in terms of who should come, so I'm not sure I believe in secondary care asthma beyond what you guys do and what intensive care do. So I think if people have got severe asthma, which is by definition, ongoing exacerbations or poor control, ongoing symptoms of asthma despite high treatment, and that means high dose ICS LABA, and or another treatment like tiotropium or montelukast. And if they're having 2 or more courses of steroids a year, then I think that they should be referred to a severe asthma service for review. If the question is really, is it asthma or not? If this 19-year-old comes back a few weeks later and they're religiously taking their steroid correctly and they're not better, then that can go to a general respiratory physician for what is the diagnosis? Are we missing something? But generally, I think primary care in terms of diagnosis, asthma nurse for post-admission or attendance follow-up, and people with recurrent, which you're in a good position at the front door to see, courses of oral corticosteroids, referral, you know, do the basics, stop smoking. This is how you use your inhaler. Here's an action plan. This is what asthma is. It's not going to go away. You need to use your treatment. And then, despite that, things aren't better, certainly refer on to a severe asthma service.
Thank you very much. Right, we'll move on to the second case.
Okay, so the second case is going to be a case who's someone who's a bit more unwell. So it's a 32-year-old lady who's come in, who's known to have asthma, and she's coming with another flare of asthma. It's a typical flare. She's breathless, she's wheezy, she's coughing up some yellow sputum, like similar to the other, our first case. But this time, this lady has a respiratory rate of 28. Her SATs are a fair bit lower at 93% on the rumour. And she's a bit tachycardic, 150 beats per minute. Blood pressure's reasonable, 120 over 85. And she's temperature's 37.2. So I suppose, how do we go about approaching this patient? What clinical features would we be looking for that would make us get concerned?
So what's interesting is another flare of her asthma. So she's got severe asthma, hasn't she? Assuming that she's on some kind of inhalers and taking them properly when she came in. But let's talk about the acute side of things. And then in case I forget, remind me to talk about the real problem here is why she showed up in the first place. It's like when you see someone with a fall and you're treating their broken ribs, what actually made them fall? So talking about the acute side of things, she's hypoxic, isn't she, with saturations of 93%. And certainly her target sats would be 94% or above. So she's going to need some oxygen. She's a little bit tachycardic, as you said, temperature neither here nor there, but she's certainly tachypneic as well. So she needs oxygen and she needs a peak flow because her peak flow might be 30% predicted and she's got kind of severe slash life-threatening asthma, or it might be 75% predicted. Either way, she needs something. I'm presuming, Peter, that she's wheezy when you listen to her and, you know, it's all asthma. There's no alternative diagnosis. It's not a pneumothorax or something. So in which case, we kind of go down the emergency management of asthma guidance. And this, again, being old-fashioned, used to be on a laminated piece of paper in Resus 1, I remember it well. But it's oxygen, bronchodilators, oral steroids, oral prednisolone, 40 milligrams is just as good as hydrocortisone, assuming she's talking to you and can take it parenterally. And repeated bronchodilators and, I'll say it again, measuring the peak flow, because it's the ones that are like this woman that are potentially a lot sicker than they appear to be that can go off really quickly. And magnesium, if things don't settle. The guidance for magnesium, there's some good evidence for IV magnesium. It's referred to in the guidelines, and we can perhaps post links to some papers.
We can do, yeah.
Aminophylline, grade D evidence, not really much evidence that it works. Kind of desperation. If things don't improve, that peak flow doesn't improve, we call our friends in intensive care, don't we? Assuming that she goes down there. And then whatever they do, they're buying time until the steroids kick in and we break that bronchospasm. So follow the algorithm in terms of managing acute asthma. Don't forget to measure the peak flow because people can be worse than you think they are. Check, as per the algorithm, I think it's every 2 hours for improvement and, you know, repeat the peak flow and watch them. And if you're not sure, call intensive care. In terms of other treatments that are mentioned on the guideline, ketamine and that kind of thing, intravenous salbutamol, I very much leave that to the intensivist. So there is some role for that, but it's all just buying time. Okay. Even intubation is buying time until you break that bronchospasm. So I'm sorry, I'm skirting over the kind of acute bit very quickly, aren't I? But
no, this is very helpful.
No. So can I just ask, could this, if she had a bit of pain in her chest, could this be a PE? A bit hypoxic, a bit tachycardic,
yeah,
a bit short of breath.
Yeah, it could. Yeah.
So can you do, I know it's probably a leading question more than anything because I've been told off for doing it before. Are you allowed to do peak flows in patients that you're querying PEs on?
Yeah. Sure.
I remember being told off by a respiratory nurse for suggesting doing a peak flow on a patient that I was questioning a PE on.
Yeah. So what do you mean by questioning? So what's the diagnosis? If they're wheezy.
Yeah.
And they've got a little bit of pleuritic chest pain, then is it a PE? If your ECG shows an S1Q3T3 and the D dimer is 10,000 and you're treating for a PE, then that's what you're treating.
Yep.
Then don't do a peak flow.
Yeah.
If you're genuinely not sure, do a peak flow. If you're treating asthma, who cares? So, you know, if you're treating a PE, and then what's a peak flow going to do?
Yeah.
If you've anticoagulated them. You know, I think it's just one of those things that, like, don't do a D dimer if someone's pregnant. I think in the first trimester, it can actually be quite useful if it's normal, can't it? So I don't think a peak flow is actually going to, if it is a PE, it's not a hemodynamically significant PE.
No, blood pressure is good, isn't it?
So I don't think actually getting them to blow hard is going to dislodge something and cause, if it is, it's going to move further down rather than back up.
So I'm not going to end up killing somebody by doing it. One peak flow, I think, good.
I think, you know, certainly if you were to request spirometry on this person, they'd say, you know, you've got suspected PE, they wouldn't do it. But again, I'm not entirely sure what the reasoning there is. If you think it's a PE, it's quick enough to exclude, isn't it, with the CTPA. If you don't think it's a PE, then peak flow's not going to do any harm.
I have a question. So I struggle with these acute severe asthmatics who come in. They get the steroids, Bataback nebulized, get IV magnesium, and you review them, might be reviewed on pulse equal about 7 hours later, even the next day. So, for example, today I saw someone who was clarking yesterday, still quite symptomatic with the flare, not particularly getting that much better. Peak flow was 150, the best
of
260.
Yeah.
But she was talking full sentences to me. She, can you give repeated boluses of IV magnesium? Is there a role there?
So the evidence for it doesn't suggest that there is a role, but I don't think there's any harm in it. And I suppose you wouldn't give IV magnesium. So you'd give IV magnesium to break acute bronchospasm. So if someone's kind of stable, let's say you see her again tomorrow and she's in the same situation, then I wouldn't necessarily give her IV magnesium if she had it and it improved her a few days later.
Okay.
I don't think there's any harm in it, but I don't think that's what it does. It's more to, once you've broken that, so when someone's, and you know, we've all seen them, haven't we? Someone has kind of come into recess and is incredibly unwell. All you're doing is breaking the back of that initial terrible bronchospasm, and then the twitchiness persists for a few days. Mm-hmm. And when they get referred to the ward, if they are referred to the ward, that's why we do peak flow charts, to see that their peak flow pre and post nebulized bronchodilator is kind of coming closer together, and sure, you're getting on top of the twitchiness. So I suppose twitchiness is different to the acute bronchospasm, which is what IV magnesium is for. So the woman you described, Peter, I wouldn't necessarily. But if I saw her tomorrow and the peak flow had gone down to 100 and she was a bit more wheezy, then I would, because you're treating acute bronchospasm and she hasn't just had IV magnesium.
Sure. Okay. I didn't give her IV magnesium for a repeat dose.
Yeah. But I wouldn't be averse to doing so, sure, if she's slipping back from twitchiness, which isn't settling, to acute bronchospasm.
Yeah. Okay.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, sure. I think that's the area where I don't know what to do. I feel like I need to give something, but I think a lot of time we just need to hold fire.
Time, isn't it?
Well, we are giving something, as in we're still giving nebulized bronchodilators. Yeah, sure. We're still giving oral steroids. Some of it just takes time. But yeah, but the reason for doing the peak flow chart, keeping an eye on things, is they can go backwards.
Yeah,
of course.
Okay. I remember a lot of our trainees do ITU placements as well during the training. And during my ITU placement, there was a young gentleman who had quite a severe flare-up of his asthma, and he was intubated. And despite the nebulizers, IV salbutamol, I think they'd given him some ketamine as well, he was still so spasmed, and they were struggling with the machine. I obviously, this was a terrifying thing, because I thought that as soon as they went to ITU, that's it, they're fixed. Clearly, it doesn't always happen. But it was the consultant just saying, we just need a bit of time, let the treatment work, we'll still continue on. There wasn't much else from a medication point of view that we could do, but it was just the time. And he did, it took some time, and he came out of it and did quite well.
Mm-hmm.
But it is that bit of time that you need sometimes.
And in that situation, Damien, even the intubation ventilation is just support until the bronchospasm breaks.
Yeah.
That's all we're trying to do. And you do need to watch them, because they can go back. But I think in my head, there is the acute bronchospasm, magnesium, bronchodilators, et cetera, et cetera. And then there is the settling of the twitchiness, which takes a bit longer.
So obviously, one of the things we've talked about, severe asthma, and obviously there's the term brittle asthma. Is that something different? Is that just severe asthmatics? Is brittle asthma an actual thing?
It's a bit of an old-fashioned term.
Mm. Are you calling me old?
Yeah, I'm calling you old-fashioned, which is not necessarily a bad thing. It's not something that we refer to particularly. If you look at post-mortem studies of asthma, everyone's got inflammation. I think we used to talk about type 1 and type 2 brittle asthma, and it's the kind of person who kind of sets off for work, everything's fine, had their cornflakes, you know, walking down the street, and then suddenly, bang, can't breathe, ends up in A&E and has got all bronchospasm, which can happen, but it kind of, that differentiation between all smooth muscle and all inflammation is kind of artificial. So we talk about severe asthma. again, as defined by ongoing exacerbations or symptoms despite a lot of treatment for asthma, review by a severe asthma service to look for comorbidities like inducible laryngeal obstruction or bronchiectasis or whatever, and treatment of those, and what you're left with is asthma. So brittle asthma, I don't use that term because it's, why don't I use it? Because I think in my head, it kind of relates to a type of phenotyping which occurred before we had much better ways of phenotyping people with asthma. Asthma is more like wine than sake. So you two sophisticated gentlemen, when you go to a restaurant, you don't just say, I want wine with my fish. You say, I want a young, fresh white wine or whatever from this vineyard. But because neither of you are Japanese and you're not familiar with sake, when you go to a Japanese restaurant, you just order sake. Although there are many types of sake, I'm sure. But I think there are better ways of phenotyping and endotyping asthma than referring to brittle asthma. So I think that's why I'm not overly keen on it.
Okay. So then obviously there, everyone gets these certain patients in the resus department that have other diagnoses along with their asthma that potentially could be causing their struggling for breathing, such as vocal cord dysfunction. I can't think of other things, but they've got a list of other things.
Disordered breathing. Yeah.
How would you treat them differently, or would you treat them differently, or would you concentrate on the asthma exacerbation?
So I suppose they're the people that can be really tricky, because if it's pure asthma, then you're guided by peak flow, you're guided by observations, etc. If there are other things going on, they can mimic asthma. And I think the ones that it's worth talking about is vocal cord dysfunction, which is, there's a term called ILO, inducible laryngeal obstruction, because it can sometimes be the false cords rather than the cords themselves. So ILO is a more umbrella term that includes vocal cord dysfunction. They can be hard to differentiate from asthma for clinicians and also for the patient. But certainly from the history, if you ask people where it is, they kind of point to their throat. If you ask them if it's harder to breathe in or out, they generally say breathe in rather than breathe out. So it's kind of different to asthma. And often their voice changes when they have an attack. And it can often come on very suddenly and be triggered by cigarette smoke, perfume, cold air, some of the things that can trigger asthma. But you can tend to tease it out in history. But again, that's more in the clinic than in the resus department. You can also get a wheeze, you can get stridor, but you can have kind of vocal cords that hover towards being closed in both inspiration and expiration. So you can get a fixed monophonic wheeze or an upper airway wheeze, and it can be very hard to differentiate. If someone's known to have VCD or ILO, if they're not known to have it, then I would refer to, that's a good reason to refer actually for a respiratory opinion, perhaps as an outpatient, to try and tease out different elements. I would treat as asthma anyway, with bronchodilators, with steroids, et cetera, et cetera. And in terms of if they're known to have ILO, then I would get help from a speech and language therapist, if possible. If they're known to have a disordered breathing pattern, I'd get help from a respiratory physiotherapist. And what we're trying to do, this is kind of where it goes from you guys to me, in that what we're trying to do here is prevent further admissions. So we ride through this admission, but this is the point at which to get specialist help to diagnose these other conditions and try and treat them and reduce the harm that we do. So the main benefit of, the really important reason to diagnose these asthma mimics is so you don't poison the patient with recurrent courses of oral corticosteroids. But in that acute situation, oral corticosteroids, there's a particular patient which you, both of you actually, when you were here some years ago, Damien, may have come across, who had 22 admissions to critical care in 1 year. And almost all vocal cord dysfunction. I'm sure he's got some asthma as well. Asthma is very hard to disprove when people are on a lot of treatment, because obviously it could be the treatment that's quelling their airflow obstruction and reversibility. But I remember giving this chap midazolam in resus when his saturations were 85 and they improved to 95. But I wouldn't advocate people doing that. I think the right thing to do is to treat the asthma side of things. But if you keep seeing this person every time, maybe just admit them under the respiratory people, because trying to get them home isn't necessarily going to help get to the bottom of things. And certainly refer as an outpatient to try and tease out these asthma mimics from the asthma. If in doubt, treat as asthma.
Yeah.
Okay. I think that's very helpful. I think that's something I always struggled with when I was a registrar, seeing those patients with vocal cord dysfunction in particular. You said at the start, remind you to talk about the real problem.
Yeah, the real problem is recurrent admissions and lack of joined upness of asthma care. So there is the hospital, there are walk-in centres, there is Salbutamol that you can buy in Asda. And there is primary care, secondary care, tertiary care. So people can actually be having lots of flare-ups of their asthma and no one knows about it. Mm. The GP doesn't know about it. The hospital doesn't know about it. You guys might know about it, but you know. So the real problem here is people with asthma, recurrent admissions, and fancy treatments that we can give them. So I guess that kind of relates to your point as to who we should refer to the severe asthma service. I think the universal messages are it's not going to go away. You need an inhaler every single day of your life. This is how to use your inhaler. And this is an action plan which tells you what to do when it gets worse, because it will intermittently get worse. And then if people are having two or more steroids, refer them on. So I think the real problem is people not understanding what asthma is as a patient, no one having explained it to them, people not using their medication, and in severe asthma, where it's not vocal cord dysfunction, we've treated all of that. As Richard Ashcroft said many years ago, the drugs don't work, they just make you worse. So there are people that, you know, stop using their medication because they've used them and they don't work. And there are lots of fancy treatments that we have for those people, but we need to find those people. So I think if you see people that, you know, that you can actually see because you've got time to piece it together, are having recurrent admissions, get the basic messages across, and then refer them onto a severe asthma center, because there might be very expensive, very targeted treatments that can change lives. Mm. And, you know, that's clearly where I spend most of my time, but the basics, this is how you use your inhaler, Right Breathe app, Right Breathe website, you need to use your inhaler every day. And this is what to do when it gets worse to stop you coming in. That's the really important bit.
Sure. Okay. That's very helpful. Do you have any questions, Damien?
No, there are lots of perils there to take away.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm going to obviously change my views on spirometry. Obviously, I'm thinking in my head about the quality improvement projects I'm going to do about asthma at the front door. So there's lots to take away. I can't wait to listen back to this podcast.
No, to be fair. It's been great. I have a final question, I suppose. What do you think we do badly at the front door?
That's an open question, isn't it?
I think
we can be. You're allowed to say nothing.
Yeah, well, nothing is all perfect. Yeah. I think it's, and this is not just you guys at the front door. I think in general, it's the awareness of other things that can be done away from the front door. So the fancy medications.
Yeah,
I think inhalers are a bit of a problem, partly because I think that, you know, there are so many people that work in A&E and AMU. You can have people that are great at inhalers, but they might not be on shift that day. So I think the very kind of the fact that there are so many inhalers and kind of not giving people advice as to which inhaler to use and why, and demonstrating inhaler technique. And this is not a criticism of any individual. I think it's a kind of systemic problem. So I think my kind of key piece of advice for that is dry powder inhaler, MDI, know how to use one of them. You know, just take the time to learn how to use one of them well, demonstrate that to the patient, and the basics of when they go home, what to do to make sure we're getting the basics right to stop them coming in again. I think that's something that we should really focus on. And I feel like I've criticized you for no reason. You know, perhaps I'm skewed. I see the people that when I dig down have been to A&E twice, and their GP three times at walk-in center once, and I'm thinking, my God. But that's easy for me because I'm seeing them and someone's referred them to me.
But it is something we should be thinking about. How can we prevent these people coming back? It's fine doing the quick fixes and getting them home, but it is harder and possibly takes a bit more time. But if it prevents their readmission in the future, that'll save you more time in the future in the long run. Absolutely. When we think about those things.
And asthma is a difficult condition to diagnose, so you have the huge advantage of being able to, you know,
do a spirometry, document the fact that they have airflow obstruction, refer them onto the right diagnostic pathway so you can clinch the diagnosis early.
Okay. Do you think it's easy getting spirometry in acute medicine, Peter?
I found it's variable. Sometimes they have been accommodating, sometimes less so.
I think it depends where you work, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think it would probably
on the services available.
I think you just ask.
Yeah.
To be fair, I don't ask. Well, maybe I should start asking now. So I just assume.
Yeah.
And we know what assuming does.
But I mean, you know, 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, perhaps not 5 to 5, but, you know, normal daytime. Why not? It's a really important test.
Yeah.
Okay.
We should probably be doing more spirometry than we do CTPAs.
Yes. I'd probably agree with you there.
Yeah. True. True.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much, Hassan. That's been fabulous. A lot of take-home pills there. That's great. Thank you.
Pleasure. Thanks, everyone. Thank you for listening, everybody.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Society of Acute Medicine podcast. We hope this episode has been interesting and helpful for you all. Please do go to the SAM website, www.acutemedicine.org.uk, for all things acute medicine, including show notes from today's episode under the education menu. You'll also find more info about acute medicine, the team, and how to contact us individually. Please do get in touch with us via Twitter using @acutemedpod. Let us know what you thought, as well as topics you'd like us to explore in future episodes, or if you would love to get involved. Thanks again for listening, and we hope you join us next time.